Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, a conundrum facing astronomers trying to measure the expansion of the universe. But first, for those of us looking forward to one day returning to the moon, experts have said it could be possible by the year 2028, less than 10 years from now. But this week, the Trump administration condensed that timeline even further. Vice President Mike Pence directed NASA to put American astronauts on the moon within the next 5 years using, quote, any means necessary. But how realistic is that? Here to tell us what we can glean from this announcement, as well as other short subjects in science, is Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer with Gizmodo. Always good to see you, Ryan.
Hey, always great to be here, Ira. How's everything going?
Fine. Let's talk about this. The Trump administration says it wants to get to the moon in 5 years. Is this possible, or is it just wishful thinking?
Well,
or?
I guess anything is possible with enough money, Ira. And I think that was the question that a lot of the people I spoke to had when they heard this was, okay, well, the Apollo mission was really expensive. Are you going to give us the money to send people to the moon in time? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yes, that's a money question. What would happen? What would have to happen? Would Congress have to suddenly say, hey, here's a pile of money to do this?
Yeah, I mean, well, so as you said, the current estimates are 2028. They want it by 2024. And I think it's just this weird sort of dissonance for me because NASA's working on the SLS, this big rocket.
Right.
They've been pushing these timelines, mm-hmm. and they've just delayed in this, the new Trump budget has actually delayed part of the SLS, and actually Bridenstine then said at this meeting that they would need that part in order to get astronauts to the moon. Well, Pence's, you know, sort of the retort is that he will, you know, he wants private industry to do it, whatever it takes, you know, get us to the moon.
That's what the whatever it takes means. It could be Elon Musk who gets us to
sure,
the moon.
Sure, yeah. And then I think part of that, it's in the context of saying, sort of declaring that we're in a new space race against China and Russia, which, okay.
Well, we need, you know, that's what got us to the moon in the first place was the space race. Maybe we need a new space race.
Maybe. You can't see me rolling my eyes on the radio. But.
Speaking of all talk and no follow through, NASA, and we had Bridenstine on the show talking about this, had to cancel the all-female spacewalk that was set to happen today, right? Because of sort of a wardrobe malfunction.
What happened was that NASA had announced earlier this month that Anne McClain and Christina Koch would be spacewalking together on the ISS, and that would be the first all-female spacewalk. And then, you know, what happened was that Koch had been scheduled due to these sizing issues, had to be rescheduled for the sizing issues on the spacesuit because the upper portion of the suit was a little too big on McClain when she wore it on last Friday. So now Koch is going to do it. But now the issue is that, well, why haven't we had an all-female spacewalk already? Like, that's the thing that I think has been bugging me and a lot of people online is they're saying, oh, it's going to happen eventually. It's not our fault. It's a wardrobe thing. But okay.
Well, if you have women on the space station, why are there not enough spacesuits for the women to wear if they have to go outside?
Well, and I thought, well, why not already have had somebody, like, why not have had another woman who could have just gone out there, right? I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can think about it.
But it didn't happen.
Did not happen. Maybe next time.
Real soon now. Next, scientists who've been trying to hunt down where all the antimatter in the universe went think they're finally on the right track?
So, you know that there's a lot more matter than antimatter in the universe.
That's why we're all here.
That's why we're here, and scientists aren't completely sure why. So what they're doing is looking for places where the laws of physics are different between matter and antimatter. Now, their regular matter and antimatter look actually pretty much the same, except for a small couple of differences. And they've actually, the Large Hadron Collider scientists at the experiment LHCb found a new, never-before-seen example of matter and antimatter seemingly behaving different in their collider. This is something that was first discovered in 1964. It was the 1980 Nobel Prize in Physics, but now they've found yet another example of this laws of physics being different, and it's textbook-making stuff.
What do you mean? Well, how different? Where might the antimatter be? Does it predict where it might be found, or how to make it? Or
it predicts. They observe differences essentially in decay rates between particles and their antiparticle pairs. Mm-hmm. And it's not enough to account for all the missing antimatter in the universe. That's going to take more research, more physics, more theories. But for now, they've got another important source, and these are still important signposts for getting us there.
Well, maybe the antimatter is hiding out with the dark energy somewhere. Next, there's another measles outbreak that erupted in New York State, and this time county officials have taken an extraordinary step to contain it.
That's right. County officials have announced a ban on unvaccinated minors in public places for 30 days or until they get the MMR vaccine. So if once it expires, it's not happening anymore. It won't be actively tracked by police, but it could be retroactively enforced.
So they have to go out, if they see somebody, they have to think that how do you enforce that, I guess is what I'm getting at.
I think you just say, you know, if in 2 years or something, or next week after it's over, you see that somebody's child went out during this time, then I guess they're arrested. The infectious disease experts, this is not punishment. It's to stop transmission and protect the vulnerable from this disease. I mean, we really are suffering this measles outbreak right now.
Finally, it seems like we've got our next candidate for the Jurassic World series. This is the largest T-Rex ever discovered.
That's right. Scotty is the T-Rex's name. And it was actually first discovered in Saskatchewan in 1991. But it's taken over a decade to both get it out of the ground and process the bones and get everything ready to actually study it. And Scotty's big.
As Johnny Carson would say, how big is it?
An estimated 19,555 pounds. So I think it's important to note that he's not physically, he's more massive by estimates than the other dinosaurs, the T-Rexes that we have. Not necessarily longer, though. So what this basically does is it just increases the upper limit of how big a T-Rex could be. So in the next Jurassic Park, you can make the T-Rex even bigger.
Any special features of this T-Rex that...
In fact, it looked like he lived we don't know the gender, but it looks like we lived a pretty tough life. It had broken ribs and infected jaw and bite marks on its tail, according to the paper.
Well, if you're the king of the jungle, everybody wants a part of you.
That's right.
All right, Ryan. Thanks. That's great.
All right. Thanks so much, Ira.
Ryan Mandelbaum, science writer with Gizmodo. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. It's becoming a recurring refrain in this era of climate change, warmer temperatures, melting glaciers, rising sea levels. Repeat. But when it comes to Greenland's Jakobshavn Glacier, it seems that cycle of disaster may have halted. Stunned scientists report in the journal Nature Geoscience this week that the ice stream, which had been retreating for two decades, has instead been thickening over the last few years. So why isn't it a cause for celebration? Joining me to tell us all the good and the bad of the glacial about-face is Ala Kazandar, a glaciologist with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Dr. Kazandar, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share our findings.
Well, Dr. Kazandar, how surprised were you to discover that after 20 years of melting, one of the Greenland's fastest melting glaciers has actually been growing?
It was quite a surprise because over the past few years, when this glacier was being studied intensively, along with many other glaciers around Greenland, the expectation was that it would continue doing what it has been for the last 20 years, which is retreating, accelerating, and thinning. And there are factors about this glacier that supported the assumption that it would continue this behavior into the future.
Okay, so what has caused the glacier to grow instead of shrink over the last couple of years?
So this has been really a natural experiment, 20 years in the making. It started in the late 1990s when scientists at the time detected the arrival of warmer waters in the vicinity of Jakobshavn. And soon after that, the glacier started this retreat, acceleration and thinning. It had a floating ice tongue or an ice shelf that was something like 15 kilometers long that that completely disintegrated by 2003. Our own measurements show that the thickness of the glacier was reduced by 160 meters or almost more than 500 feet near the front. So what we detected now is basically the reversal of what happened all that time ago, which is the arrival of cooler waters in the vicinity of the glacier. And we hypothesized that this reversed the processes involved and resulted in the re-advance, the slowing down and the thickening of the glacier.
So why this arrival of the cold water? Is this a permanent thing, temporary thing?
Unfortunately, we strongly suspect that it is a temporary reprieve than a resurrection of the glacier. It is most likely connected to a cyclical phenomenon, a good candidate, something called the North Atlantic Oscillation, and the water warmers will be coming back.
Isn't that sort of like an El Nino sort of thing, like we have in the Pacific, an oscillation then?
They are cousins.
They're cousins, kissing
yes.
cousins. You mean it's the same kind? It's the same kind of change in the water temperature.
Yes, I mean it's an atmospheric phenomenon that affects also the circulation of the ocean, the temperatures of the ocean, the heat exchange between the ocean and the atmosphere, and so on.
And so, how long do we expect this to last then?
I don't think anybody knows. It could be back to doing what it did in the coming 2 years or so, or it could take a bit longer. Mm-hmm. But we know, and this is the bad news part of it, that most of the heat added to the atmosphere, mostly due to human activity, is actually absorbed into the ocean, more than 90% of it. So there is a high probability that when the warm waters come back again, they'll be even warmer.
So that will remelt the glacier.
Yes, and there is something very about this glacier that makes it even more vulnerable. The bedrock on which it lies is beneath sea level, and it deepens the further you go inland, which means that this warm embrace between the ocean and the glacier will continue for decades to come. And we have demonstrated how sensitive it is to the warming wow. of ocean waters. So this implies that this retreat might continue, and most likely will continue for decades to come. Mm.
Thank you, Dr. Kazandar, for taking time to be with us today.
You're most welcome. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Ala Kazandar, glaciologist with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We're going to take a break and come back and look at the stars and see answers like, how fast is the universe expanding and why that's in doubt? We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. Hey there, Ira here. You know, I've been looking back at the first quarter of 2019, and I gotta say that some of my favorite conversations on Science Friday have happened in the last 3 months. As you know, space is always one of my favorite topics. So we were eager to bring NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine on the show to answer your questions. We also discussed how exercise could reshape our hearts, which is bizarre and incredible to think about. And my favorite segment, because each one of these kids inspires me, was the one with several guests that were under 21 years of age and winning some of the world's toughest science competitions, as well as driving national conversations to protect the climate. You know, these are fascinating times we're living in, and science and technology are the forefront of the news. We are working extra hard to stay on top of everything, bringing you the most important, relevant, and interesting conversations we can. But we need your donations to support our work. So if you go to sciencefriday.com/give and give whatever you can, you'll help keep us being the trusted news service you deserve. Again, that's sciencefriday.com/give, or just follow the links from the upper right-hand corner of our website. It's that easy. sciencefriday.com/give. And now back to the show, and thanks.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban.
A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, I'm out of here.
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know the story. Once upon a time, everything in the universe was crammed into a very small space, and then the Big Bang. And the universe has been expanding ever since. Well, so the theory goes. But just how fast is it expanding? Calculating that expansion rate is a problem dating back almost 100 years when Edwin Hubble used data from Harvard astronomer Henrietta Swan Leavitt to define the expansion rate as a number that came to be called the Hubble constant. But the value of that constant has been hard to pin down. Two different approaches to measuring the Hubble constant have come up with close but different, significantly different answers. Joining me now to talk about why that matters are my guests. Anil Ananthaswamy is a science journalist and author based in the Bay Area. He recently wrote about this for Scientific American. Welcome to Science Friday, Anil.
Hi, Ira. It's good to be on the show. Thank you.
Nice to have you. And Professor Adam Riess, he is a 2011 Nobel laureate in physics, a professor of astronomy and physics at Johns Hopkins University, senior member of the science staff at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. Welcome back, Dr. Riess.
Hi, Ira. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. All right, Anil, let me start with you. What is the Hubble constant in lay terms?
The Hubble constant tells us about how fast the universe is expanding, and it's related to the, if you're looking at some galaxy, then if you know the distance to that galaxy and you know how fast that galaxy is receding from us, you can use those two numbers to calculate the Hubble constant, which tells you how fast the universe is expanding.
And Dr. Riess, why is it so hard to measure then?
Yeah, well, it's just the universe, after all. That should be pretty simple. it's not that it's so hard. It's that it's so hard to measure it so precisely, and particularly when you see a disagreement that may tell us something really interesting about the universe, you want to be really right about your measurements. So we've been measuring and remeasuring for about a decade using the Hubble Space Telescope to calibrate the universe. And we think, the most precise answer to date, which is the answer we presented last week.
But that answer is in disagreement with other measurements, is it not, Anil?
Yeah, so that measurement is quite significantly in disagreement with another way of measuring it, which is the value that comes from the European Space Agency's Planck satellite. So they measure the cosmic microwave background, which is radiation left over from about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And that radiation has features in it that you can use in order to correlate what happened in the early universe with what's happening now and use that to calculate estimate the expansion rate now. And those two ways of doing it, Adam's group and the Planck data, are in disagreement.
So, Adam, how do you measure it?
How do I measure it? Well, I use different kinds of exploding and pulsating stars in the nearby universe, and by calibrating their luminosity using geometrical methods like building triangles in space, we can determine how far away they are from how bright they appear. And then we measure what's known as the redshift. And as Anil described, that tells us how fast the universe is expanding today.
Mm-hmm. Our number, if you'd like to talk about it, is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. So why do you think there is this discrepancy, and if it seems to be a significant one, why is there, Dr. Riess?
Well, let me give you an analogy. Imagine you were trying to measure your height. And one person started at your feet and measured to your head, and the other person started at your head and measured to your feet. And if they got different answers, you'd say, well, you know, somebody's made a mistake. That's not so interesting. But let me imagine in a different way. Instead, somebody measured your height when you were 2 years old. Now, when you're 2 years old, if you're like an average person, you reach about half your height of your eventual height. And so, you know, you double that number and you say, okay, I'm 3 feet tall when I'm 2 years old. I guess I'll be 6 feet tall when I'm all grown up. Then we go out and we actually measure, and oh my gosh, you turn out to be, you know, 7'2". You're going to play center for the Knicks. But what's exciting is something has gone awry in our understanding. So what we failed to mention was that the other measurement, the one made from the cosmic microwave background, is not really a measurement as much as a prediction. It is a measurement when the universe was very young, and then we use our understanding of the physics of the universe to figure out how fast the universe will be expanding today. And just like that child who has grown up, we then go out and measure how fast or how tall the child is, and we find a very different, very surprising answer. And that's why this is really so exciting. It's not just like two people measuring the same thing and getting a different number. It's two scientists or two teams of scientists measuring at opposite ends of the history of the universe and finding that those two do not connect, that there is something missing or another wrinkle in how we understand the universe.
And both teams of scientists are dug in on. They really pretty sure that they've got the right number, right, Anil?
Yeah, I mean, both teams have, reduced their errors substantially. So, you know, the Planck team is very confident of its measurements. And, you know, as Adam said, they're measuring the cosmic microwave background with very high precision. But then they have to use this thing called the Standard Model of Cosmology to extrapolate to the universe as it is now and make estimates of the Hubble constant. So, but the actual measurement date, you know, the precision of the measurements is very high. And as is, you know, the data coming from Adam's team.
So, Adam, what does it matter? What does it matter if it's 67 or 74?
Right.
You know?
Right. It's true. I don't actually care what the number is. What I care about is that these two ways disagree and that it might tell us something interesting about the universe. So, for your listeners who may or may not know, about 95% of the universe, we believe, is made up of dark matter and dark energy. These are these mysterious components that we see only by their gravity, but we don't really have a detailed understanding of their physics. They're very mysterious to us. So when we, as Anil said, when we extrapolate from the youthful universe to the present universe, we take some very naive guesses about the nature of that dark matter and dark energy. And so if those naive guesses are failing, if we're seeing this important difference, it may be teaching us something really crucial, an important clue about the nature of dark matter or dark energy. And that's why we make these kinds of measurements, really to learn more about these mysterious components.
Well, you know, if you don't know what 95% of the universe is made of, I mean, you don't know anything.
Hey, we know it's there.
Isn't that right? I mean, why should this little, you know, what could these numbers teach you about learning what 95% of the universe is made of?
Yeah, well, you know, this becomes a quantitative game at some point. I mean, as I said, we use gravity. This is sort of the new science of cosmology in the last few decades, is to recognize, hey, most of the universe is not made out of what we're made out of. And in fact, most of the universe doesn't emit light like things we're familiar with. We have to use gravity like a telescope to see parts of the universe. Dark matter, dark energy, you may have heard of gravitational waves, which we are just getting the ability to see. And so these are our new observing tools that we're using to learn about gravity. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were a blind person walking through a room, you know, you'd have to use a different set of senses to figure out what's in the room. And so that's where we are.
Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Terry. Hi, welcome to Science Friday in Sioux City.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, go ahead.
I was wondering if it isn't the word constant that might be the issue here. That assumes that it's the same throughout the entire universe, and maybe the universe is expanding at different rates in different places.
Right. That's a great question. We actually have used these same tools to determine if the universe is expanding at the same rate in different directions. And in fact, that has been confirmed to very high precision. But you're also right that constant is kind of a funny misnomer anyway, because it is a number that will change as the universe ages. It's just we think constant at any one point in time, but the same in all directions.
Could the dark energy that is pushing the universe further apart, could that have something to do, you know, we don't know anything about it with the Hubble, the number being wrong?
Yeah, that is, in fact, one of the possibilities. You know, we take a very, I would say, vanilla guess at what the nature of dark energy is. And we've tried to measure that. And, you know, it roughly looks like that vanilla guess. But, you know, that could be part of the story of what's going on, is that we have kind of a turbocharged dark energy that makes the universe accelerate and expand even faster today.
Neil, I'm going to bring another one of our favorite topics into this. And this is like a black holes and gravity waves. Is there a LIGO measuring, you know, that could be the referee of these two other measurements?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's going to be the exciting thing over the next 5 years. So your listeners will know that LIGO, which is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, detected gravitational waves from the merging of black holes in the past few years. But in August of 2017, it had another event that it observed that was actually very interesting, which was the merger of two neutron stars. And so these two neutron stars, when they merged, they generated gravitational waves, but they also generated a burst of electromagnetic radiation. And in order to calculate the Hubble constant, you need two things, right? You need the distance to some astrophysical object, and you also need to measure its recession velocity. So the gravitational wave signature from the neutron star merger gave the LIGO team a way to tell the distance to this merger event. And the electromagnetic radiation, which was captured by other telescopes, gave them redshift information, which then allowed them to figure out how fast this is receding from us. Putting those two together, they came up with a Hubble constant value of 70, which sits bang in the middle of the Planck and the data from Adams' group, except that their error bars, because it's just one event and they just don't have enough data to have good statistical significance, the error bars are so big that they can accommodate both Planck and the result from Adams' group. So what's exciting is that, you know, this week, LIGO announced that they have upgraded their instrument and have restarted observations, and they're going to, I think, in about a year's time, close it down and upgrade again. So over the next 5 years, they're hoping to observe about 50 such neutron star mergers, and that will give them enough data to, you know, pin down this number to within 2%. And it will be really exciting to see which way, you know, they move, whether they move towards Planck or whether they move towards the data from Adams' group.
Very interesting. I have a tweet from Sarah who asks a question that's been asked of everybody for the last 100 years, and I want to repeat it. If the universe is everywhere, you know what I'm going to say, how is it expanding? Is it becoming more infinite, Adam?
Oh, I was hoping you were going to ask Anil this question.
I was going to punt it to Adam.
Yeah. What we really mean when we say the universe is expanding is we mean locally around us, and as far as we could tell, everywhere else, that whenever two things are separated, like galaxies, that separation grows. We can't really verify what happens much further than we could see. There's a limit. We can only see as far as the age of the universe times the speed of light. But we believe that the universe continues to expand. And so if it's infinite, it's infinite and getting bigger. You know, as my father used to like to say, what's bigger than infinity? Well, infinity plus one.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Now you're getting into Aleph and Aleph 1 and Cantor, all those sort of things. We have a lot of calls who are interested in whenever we talk about the universe, people want to talk about the universe and its expansion. And that tweet reminded me of a letter I saw many years ago that was sent to Einstein himself about what happens if you poke your thumb through the finite universe. Where does it go? You know, that sort of stuff has been around all the time. You already, here's another tweet. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to line four. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Charles and
Hello,
Dave.
Ira.
Hi, Charles. Go ahead.
Yes, Ira, thank you. I would like to know if the CMB boundary is expanding, or is it too far to tell if it's expanding?
The cosmic background radiation that's left over from the Big Bang.
Right. Well, the cosmic microwave background radiation is actually a tiny slice in time. It's a snapshot of the universe at a certain moment, the moment when the universe went from being a fog where light couldn't really propagate very far until it suddenly became thin enough, diluted enough by the expansion of space that it suddenly gets out. And so it's not really expanding, but it is getting more distant from us in time as time goes on. But because we can always look back to it and it's in all directions, it's always available to us. We can always see it.
Well, let me just wrap up because we're running out of time. Is it possible that we need new physics here? Could there be particles, unknown particles, unpredicted particles?
Yes. Yes, I would say, on our menu of possibilities are new particles, like what we would call a sterile neutrino, exotic dark energy, dark matter that interacts or decays, another episode of dark energy, all kinds of interesting possibilities, and that's why we're so excited about this this discrepancy.
But do you have the tools to discover those new particles?
I think so. New tools are coming online. The various predictions of what would happen if you had exotic particles make specific predictions of, you know, what other signatures you should see. So sometimes this is just the way science works is, you know, you might get your first clue and your first clue leads to a hypothesis. And that hypothesis recommends another experiment. And so we may be going through a generation of that now.
Let me see if I can get a quick caller in from Johnny in Beacon, New York. Hi, John. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. How's it going, guys? Great discussion. My question was, could these potential differences in measurements from these two groups be based off of, we always assume that the initial Big Bang caused an ever-expanding universe as a constant in one direction. What if the universe hit a point where then it were to retract and almost come back to, let's say, that initial point based off of gravitational pull? Is there any evidence why that is not possible? And I think we always just assume that it was ever.
Okay, I got about 30 seconds for an answer. Adam?
Well, I could jump in here on this one. We don't really get a good glimpse of the universe between the time shortly after the Big Bang to, the last, 7 or 8 billion years. And so there's kind of a dark ages in there. If the universe took a break, it took a snooze during that, we wouldn't know. And that really could also mess up these calculations. Of course, we would look for what is the exotic new physics that explains why that would happen. Generic as a statement, we don't think the universe took a break.
Thank you, Adam. Adam Rees, 2011 Nobel Laureate in Physics, talking with us. Also, Anil Ananthaswamy, a science journalist, author based in the Bay Area, working for Science, Scientific American every once in a while. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the flu. Did you avoid the flu this season? We're going to talk about flu near you. It was our citizen science project that you all helped to create to give real-time updates on how the virus spread this season. We have the results. They're in. If I had a bell, I'd ring it. But we'll be back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We can finally say it. Spring is officially here. The days are getting longer and warmer. We're at the tail end of the flu season, though not quite done yet. This flu season, we teamed up with Flu Near You, a citizen science project to track the flu spread across the country in real time. We asked you, faithful listeners, to help out by tracking your symptoms. And boy, did you answer the call. You briefly broke the internet, did you know that? And Flu Near You's website in the process. So what did the flu look like this season? And within our sci-fi community, here to tell us all about it are my guests, Kristen Baltusaitis, was a research assistant for Flu Near You. She's also a biostatistics graduate student at Boston University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
You've been plated with your PhD, is that right?
Yes, I'm a three-day-old doctor.
Oh, congratulations. I hope your mom's happy.
Thank you so much.
And Ariel Zick, she's Science Friday's education director. Ariel, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira.
Okay, Kristen, at first, congrats, as I say, on your minted PhD, but remind us how FluNear you works. What are you asking people to keep track of?
So essentially, we refer to FluNearU as a participatory syndromic surveillance system. What we mean by that is we recruit a cohort of citizen scientists across the country to report every week whether or not they have any symptoms. Mm. And from those symptom reports, we can kind of track influenza-like illness within the general population.
And Ariel, how many SciFry listeners participated?
Well, we did so well. So we had by the time all was said and done, everyone registered, we had just over 2,900 active users for the length of the project, which means we had 2,900 people reporting their weekly flu symptoms. And they were even doing it for other people in their household. So the whole Science Friday cohort represented about 3,500 people.
Wow, we broke the internet, you say?
We did yes. When we first announced that people could sign up, members of Science Friday's audience from all 50 states flooded to the site, immediately tried to register, immediately broke the website. We fixed it. And those who hung on with us, they've turned out to be really good reporters. So part of the fun of syndromic surveillance is that data, even when you're feeling well, that's good data. So we ask people to report every week. And Science Friday listeners, you guys did well. They really did.
And you found out some surprising facts, too, like whales get the flu.
Yes, that's right. So every week we sent a little text reminder to our participants who wanted them to kind of remind them to log their symptoms. But we also sent some fun flu facts, and we learned things like influenza viruses, especially influenza A viruses, are very promiscuous. They jump around all sorts of species. So whales can get sick with it, and so do seals and ferrets and minks. And, you know, while those are dead-end hosts, we also, you know, they get infected by some of the same routes that other peoples do. So just through contamination of water. But we also learned some fun things like that there's a Black Friday for flu symptoms in outpatient clinics. So everybody stays home for Thanksgiving. They get lazy or they don't feel like going to the doctor over a holiday. And so if you're looking at influenza-like illness in, for instance, in the FluNearU population, you'll usually see a spike in outpatient clinics for people showing up with these flu-like symptoms because they kind of held off until the day after Thanksgiving to check in. So we learned a whole bunch of fun flu natural history as a part of this process.
That's great. Dr. Baltrusaitis, the CDC keeps track of influenza. How can this type of stuff that we do give us a different picture?
So the CDC has a really well-established influenza surveillance system. However, their surveillance depends upon individuals going to the doctor. Our system differs because we look at the entire population. So most people that do have influenza-like illness don't actually go to the doctor. So the goal of our system is to kind of capture those individuals as well. And then we can provide the CDC with additional information, like what percent of those individuals that are experiencing those symptoms actually do go to the doctor. Mm-hmm. So we think about this as a very complementary surveillance system to the CDC.
Can you tell how this flu season went from the point of view of FluNearU? Was this flu season like, well, what trends did we see? How well did the vaccinations work? Stuff like that. Kristen?
So we can look at influenza-like illness. So we can look at those that are vaccinated versus unvaccinated. However, the vaccination is, we use influenza-like illness, which is a proxy for actual influenza. So we look at the symptoms that are very consistent with influenza. So we can't actually look at vaccination effectiveness, but we can look at what proportion of individuals within the population are actually vaccinated and whether or not they're experiencing symptoms that are related to the flu.
And Ariel, Science Friday, as you say, Science Friday listeners certainly heeded the call. And how did our listeners compare to the rest of the FluNearU population?
So that was something that I was really interested to think about because I think our audience is a unique bunch of people, but also because we had assembled this around right at the beginning of the flu season, and I was thinking, I wonder how they're going to be different. And we did find some interesting things. So I mentioned that they were good reporters. They reported just a little more consistently than FluNearU users did on average, but there were also some other interesting differences. They seemed to get sick less often, or at like at any given point in time, a smaller proportion of Science Friday users were experiencing influenza-like illness or those influenza symptoms we talked about than average. And so, you know, that kind of piqued my interest a little bit. I was thinking, well, what is, you know, maybe it's that they're all super vaccinated, so we just have a really high vaccination rate. But when we started picking that apart a little bit, it looked like their vaccination rates, at least their self-reported vaccination rates, were similar to a general audience. And so, you know, that kind of led down this rabbit hole of what are some of the, you know, what could be going on, and why are Science Friday listeners so healthy? You know, and that's one of the fun things about a project like this is I think there's still a lot to learn about this type of monitoring.
Kristen, do you have any explanations for this? Are listeners extra healthy, or is this due to how they might be reporting their symptoms?
Everything that I thought, I was like, well, maybe there's differences in ages and there's fewer younger individuals, but the population distribution looks very similar to flu near you, so I guess we just have a really healthy Science Friday population.
We're very happy.
We did
about
find that there were a lot of young people in that cohort. That was a really pleasant surprise. So, Science Friday users, you know, we expected them to be fairly evenly distributed across age groups, but it turned out, Kristen, we had a fair number of teenagers participating, didn't we? Yeah.
Approximately 15% of the users were in the 13 to 17 age range.
That's
which
terrific.
Is really exciting that we're getting these younger individuals interested in science, in citizen scientists.
We're happy to hear that. I want to bring on another guest who uses this information on the ground, Karen Martin, senior epidemiologist at the Minnesota Department of Health in St. Paul. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So how has the Minnesota Department of Health used this data that Flu Near You tracks?
Well, we've been working with Flu Near You data for a couple of years now, and Minnesota was one of two states this past year that received a small amount of funding to work on a project that we call Confirmed Flu Near You, where we're actually looking at the users within our state and then thinking what would happen if we sent the users, asked them if they wanted to sign up for an enhanced surveillance, and sent them some swabs along with some mailing kits, and asked them when they got sick if they would do a self-swab in the nose, package it up, and send it to our public health laboratory for us to test. And so we are looking at not only reports of influenza-like illness from Flu Near You users in our state, but we're also getting a subset of samples so that we can see of those who are reporting illness, what actually do they have? And so that's been really interesting to see. And as I think it was mentioned before, you know, this is really giving us a window into a population that we don't have a lot of information about. So while we normally have a lot of data on medically attended influenza, people who are going to the doctor's office, people going to the hospital, we really have little information on people who are sick but are not going to the doctor's office. So this was really a great opportunity to see what's going on in that population. Mm-hmm. And what we found is we are finding flu. We did find some influenza. And in addition to influenza, we tested it also for some other respiratory pathogens. And just like you would expect, it's a little bit of a viral soup, some other things going on there. But one interesting thing that we did find was, as every flu season is interesting, I should say, is that we did see sort of a change from the dominant strain in the Flu Near You data. So at the beginning of the season, we were seeing more influenza A, H1, but towards the middle, towards the end of the season, we were seeing it switch over to influenza A, H3. And that was reflected in our other data as well. So like I said, it's given a nice supplement to the rest of our influenza surveillance data.
How would you compare this to last season? If I recall, last year was a pretty severe flu season,
yes,
was it not?
Last season was record-breaking in a number of ways. I mean, we had record number of hospitalizations, record number of deaths due to influenza. You know, a lot of the indicators that we used to describe how severe a season it was. And certainly, I want to say any influenza season is severe and that we do have people that get very sick and very die. But certainly, it was nowhere as severe as it was last season. So for that, we're grateful.
We are. So how much longer do we have to endure the season?
Well, that is a million-dollar question, but I think it's safe to say that we certainly have, you know, several weeks left of activity, and it could depend on what part of the country you're in, but at least in Minnesota, we really just hit peak activity within the past couple of weeks, so we're really still expecting high activity in the weeks to come, so we're definitely not out of the woods yet.
You know, speaking of last year, adding to the severe flu outbreak, we also did not have a vaccine that worked very well. How's the cocktail this year working?
It's a cocktail. I like that expression. Well, you know, unfortunately, the vaccines that we're able to produce right now are not 100% effective. So you're always going to have, you know, the possibility of getting a vaccine and still, you know, potentially getting the flu. So, you know, for this season, I believe it's in the upper 40s as far as percent effective, but that's for getting influenza. Now, if you look at other outcomes such as being hospitalized for influenza or dying of influenza, you know, the efficacy is going to be, you know, much higher. So definitely still worth it. But I think, you know, I think the search is on for a vaccine that that does have better efficacy. But definitely still worth it to get vaccinated.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking about the flu near you with Kristen Baltrusaitis, Karen Martin, and Ariel Zitch, and about this flu season. When we say flu map, Karen, some people think that you're trying to make a weather forecast for the flu, but you're interested in surveillance, right? There is a difference.
Yes, I'm sorry. Did you say Karen?
Yes.
Yes, for surveillance, yes. So right now with flu, the difficulty with flu is that it is, and I think it was mentioned before, the virus is constantly changing. And so what we are trying to do is we are trying to gather enough data, and surveillance data is finding out who is getting sick and, you know, are there certain groups or certain people who are getting disproportionately affected so that we can better target our interventions, be that vaccination or do we need to get some better public health messaging about how to better prevent, you know, the spread of disease. So that's, you know, when we put out maps and talk about surveillance, we're really talking about, you know, who is sick and where are they sick.
Kristen, how many people do you need to report to be able to make a surveillance map?
So based upon some of our studies, we noticed that if you have like about 300 to about 500 individuals within a given geographical area, you can track the ILI symptoms within that population fairly well. Again, obviously, the more individuals that you have, the better your estimates will be. So yeah. We encourage everybody to participate.
And so you'll be collecting data all year round, right? How can people participate? Go to our website?
Yep. If you go to Flu Near You, you can register to be a reporter, and we do encourage individuals to report all year round. So we don't just track symptoms associated with influenza, we track other symptoms. So a few years ago, back in 2014, there was an outbreak of the intramurovirus. So we were able, even though that was in September and prior to the start of the flu season, we were able to kind of track that virus within our population.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that we get these baselines all throughout the year.
Always important. And Ariel, can people go over to the SciFry stats site and look it up? Stuff they want to
yes.
see?
Yes. Yes. Please come and navel gaze with us. Look at how you guys all fared. I think, you know, we mentioned the percentage of individuals that in the Science Friday's cohort who got sick. That percentage over time is available on our site at sciencefriday.com. You'll see the link right on the homepage. But also browse a little bit through and explore some of the differences between cohorts. Certainly you'll I think you'll be surprised at some of the things we found and didn't find when we started making some of those comparisons.
And Dr. Martin, one last question, a little bit out of left field for you as a senior epidemiologist, because I have you here on the phone.
All right.
Do you think we will start to track measles outbreaks?
Well, we definitely are tracking measles outbreaks. And, you know, unlike flu, where we cannot track every case, we are definitely doing our best to track every case of measles. But as far as on the something like flu near you, you know, I would hope that that every case of measles would be immediately reported to a healthcare facility and a health department rather than just on the internet. But I think it does have the potential to track other types of diseases, mm-hmm. such as a rash illness. But I would hope that measles in particular would have a little more urgency. But that's my opinion.
Karen Martin, senior epidemiologist at Minnesota Department of Health in St. Paul. Kristen Baltusidis, research assistant for Flu Near You, and Ariel Zitch, Science Friday's education director. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much, Ira.
And as Ariel says, you can go to our website to see those Flu Near You stats, and we also have an article up there where you can see the flu virus. You can see it up close under an electron microscope. It's pretty interesting to look at. Go to sciencefriday.com. One last thing before we go. Science Friday is putting on a night of science and spirits at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry in Portland. Ever wonder about the scientific origin behind the word alcohol? I'm sure you have, and you want to learn how to make a spirit with your own saliva? Discover with us on Friday. That's April 5th. Go to sciencefriday.com/cocktail to grab your ticket before our last call. sciencefriday.com/cocktail. Discover Friday, April 5th. That's going to the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. That's about all the time we have today. We had technical help from Sarah Fishman, Kevin Wolf, Rich Kim. Our director is Charles Berquist. Senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Feather. And of course, every day now is Science Friday because we are all over social community. You can have your smart speaker play an edition of Science Friday whenever you want. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.